businesses are living, breathing organizations that have lots of different personalities you have to take into account.
You were a millionaire by 20 years old.
I'm the oldest of 10, so I've got 4 younger brothers and 5 younger sisters. Twice as many siblings as I do cousins. How much money does one person ever need for themselves? Like, I don't really care about material things to a certain extent. It can come to the detriment of other things, you know, personal relationships, your ability to balance. And it's about being careful with what you say yes to with your time. You know, I would rather stay home and, you know, just work on my computer versus going out to some kind of random event that's not going to have any tangible benefit for the time I invest in it. I don't think it's ever possible to fully give 100% into something, but you want to get as close as you can. For the final project, they had assigned us to, you know, to submit a business plan. So I basically just copied what I gave the bank, a bad grade on the project, but I got, you know, an approval from the bank to go buy the second business.
Hi, Josh.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure. Nice to meet you. We will dive into your backstory a bit to understand how you become who you become today. But let's start with that phrase. You were a millionaire by 20 years old. How did that feel? And how is the Josh different today that sits in front of me?
That's a good question. I think, you know, my story, and we'll get into it, but being in my spot at 20 years old, you know, having bought my third business, I my claim to fame, I tell people, is I bought 3 businesses with SBA loans before I could legally drink. And I've got a funny story because I moved into a nice building with a good friend of mine who I became friends with over the time. I told him, oh, I just moved in. We had a bar in the building, but I couldn't drink. So I was a resident of the building and I could bill drinks back to my room, but I couldn't legally drink, but they still let me drink anyway. But you know, success at a young age, it comes, I think it's a very double-edged thing because you have to spend so much time and so much of your life working on whatever it is that garnered you that success. It can come to the detriment of other things, you know, personal relationships, your ability to balance. And I've learned over time that you really have to balance certain things in your life. And you know, depending on who you talk to, some people will say, you know, balance is bad. You have to go all in. I think after a certain point, if you don't handle, especially like personal health, if you don't balance it, it can be a huge detriment to you. Mm-hmm. So if there's anything that I've learned over the last couple of years, it's really that making sure to prioritize your health and being able to perform at your best is just as important as whatever success you're chasing, because you might be doing very well in the business that you're running, but if you burn out personally, you know, your business is going to suffer. So it's a very double-edged sword, I would say.
That is absolutely true. And I think that is why so many health and wellness and longevity, all of that grows so much, because people understood that being a CEO or being an executive or a leader or an acquirer, that requires so much more than just the time that you put in. It also requires your creativity and so much more. So maybe what are the things you felt that you missed out on when you were starting that route of success so young?
Yeah, so I didn't go to college like in person. I did mine online. And I kind of tell people I'm technically, I never finished. I was like 2 classes short. And I've got a funny story about that. I had already bought my first business, and I did college through a lot of what are called CLEP and AP exams. So it's just credit by exam programs where you don't actually have to attend classes. And I picked a college that would allow me to transfer a significant portion of them over. And what happened was I was in process of buying my second business. And at the same time, I was taking a small business finance class, which was like in the 3 or 401 level class. And the teacher that I had for the final project, they had assigned us to, you know, to submit a business plan. And so I basically just copied what I gave the bank and they approved the loan to get, you know, give me the money to buy the second business. But I got a bad grade on the project itself because it was like formatting, small things like formatting and small technical things. And I had a real issue with that because I said, you know, at the end of the day, the real world doesn't care about if my APA formatting is perfect. Right? They don't care about all these things. They care about whether what you're putting together is practical, actionable, and something you can actually execute on. So I got a bad grade on the project, but I got, you know, an approval from the bank to go buy the second business. It was kind of at that point I was like, all right, I'm going to put this off to the side. I think I'm just going to go focus on work, you know, because I could have had my degree done by about 20 years old. like right when I turned 20, I could have had my degree done, but I just decided not to finish it because I was like, I would rather just go spend all my time and effort on things that actually matter that are going to have a real impact in my life. Whereas, you know, nobody asks me where I went to school these days. It doesn't matter.
I mean, you're also pretty, I wouldn't say famous, but you get yourself out there to share what you do and what you've done on various levels. So I think in the last 10 years, you have been pretty vocal about how you did certain things and how you achieved it. So people don't ask you for your degree because you have that. But to be fair to other people who study, it's like some people don't. And some people actually rely on whatever their university is. So I would not say that that is a good route to go. But
well, I think it also depends. If you want to become like a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer, you have to go to school. There are certain professions that having the education, it's a prerequisite to doing well because you have to learn a lot about it. Mm-hmm. But I think for a lot of people, you know, a lot of people that are considering college, especially nowadays, it's a question of, is this going to be worth the payoff? Because you see, you know, a lot of companies, they're having layoffs or, you know, the hiring that is happening, they don't care as much about whether you have a degree. I think it was Palantir recently. They said they were having like a fellowship program where they didn't care if people actually went. They were basically just taking kids straight out of high school to go through a training course to work there. And so it's like at the end of the day, you don't have to indebt yourself to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars to get a good job if you have specific skill sets like, you know, creative writing, you know, your ability to communicate. And I think your ability to communicate and your ability to think critically is very important. And I think a lot of employers are starting to realize that, you know, having a piece of paper, it can be helpful. I'm not going to say that having a degree, especially from a good college, it's not going to hurt you. But at the same time, it's not a prerequisite to success in many respects.
I need to say, I would even say some things are going to hurt you. From my experience, because the example you just gave, right, that professors are so detail orientated in certain things that really don't matter. And I faced that in some points where I was like, I really want to not do that because I know it gets my brain to a wrong direction. You know, it wires my brain wrongly in a sense. But university is not the major part about your life. And we want to talk about you today. So what are you doing now? What is mostly of the time that you spend and how have you developed there?
Yeah, so as of recently, I've started and I'm probably going to be announcing it a little bit shortly, but I'm starting a decentralized crowdfunding platform. The crypto space is one that's always been of interest to me, but I see a lot of projects that don't actually have a real product. The product that we're building, it's effectively a replacement to some of the more centralized crowdfunding platforms that are out there right now. So that's taking up the most of my time. We're hoping to have the minimally viable, you know, the MVP product launched by the end of the year. But right now we're just raising money to help scale that project. I'm also involved with some other investment opportunities in real estate with my brother. He does, you know, like low income housing, Section 8. So we've been getting involved in that space a little bit more. But yeah, between those two, that's what's taking up most of my time. I still do a little bit of consulting here and there for people that are looking to buy businesses. I had a consulting business that I ran a little bit before, specifically for that. We help people that were trying to buy businesses or, you know, structure partner buyouts with SBA loans. So I do a little bit of that from time to time. But the bulk of my time as of right now, it's focused on this crypto project.
That sounds really exciting and a high growth space.
Yes, very much.
You mentioned your brother. How did you grow up? What is your...
Yeah, so I'm the oldest of 10. I don't know if I'd mentioned that, or some people who know me, they know that I have a big family. So I'm the oldest of 10. So I've got 4 younger brothers and 5 younger sisters.
That is a lot. How did your parents get up with that? Like, they need to be super structured.
Well, yeah, my dad was a career Army officer, and my mom stayed home to help manage all the kids. So I think that was her being able to stay full time at home to watch the kids was instrumental in being able to manage that many kids. But I tell people, especially families that have only maybe 2 or 3 kids, after you have like 3 or 4 kids, things become a little bit easier because the kids kind of manage each other. So I remember growing up, a lot of times, you know, my mom wasn't having to watch one-on-one every little child to make sure they didn't get into a mess because there was other kids that were there to prevent the younger children from getting into trouble. So
did you prevent your siblings getting into trouble?
No, they still got into trouble plenty of times. So
my brother tried to get me out of trouble, and I'm a triplet.
So you're a triplet. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a bit different. But my brother always tried to get me out of trouble. I was not to hold back from any trouble. You couldn't do that.
Which number are you in the triplet?
The first.
You're the first. Okay.
Yes. So having these 10 siblings, what did that teach you in a sense of like how the world functions and what are your motives that you can take from there to your world today?
That's a good question. I think growing up with a lot of siblings, it's a unique experience because obviously most people don't have, you know, more than two or three siblings. You know, for example, I only have four cousins. So I've you know, twice as many siblings as I do cousins. And I would say the biggest thing that you can learn, especially from being an older sibling, it's just about managing relationships. Because, and I found this out running my first business pretty early, buying a business, it's more than just, you know, do the numbers on paper make sense? It's also about, is there going to be a cultural conflict? You know, for the first business I bought, most of the staff were Filipino. And there's certain aspects of Filipino culture that I understood because I spent a lot of time growing up in Hawaii. And I was able to understand that culture. I was familiar with it. The partner that I brought in, who was our office administrator, he came from a much different background. And he didn't really mesh very well with people at the office because he was a lot more blunt, direct, and you know, abrasive, which for certain types of people, that's fine. They appreciate someone being blunt and direct with them. But especially in Asian cultures, it's very, very much not the case. You're not as you don't want to be direct with people. You don't call people out. If you have a problem with them, you know, you pull them aside and address it quietly. And so, you know, managing relationships from a personal level with that many younger siblings, just knowing how each sibling was different, how they interacted with the other siblings, I think that carried over pretty well for me being able to spot, you know, clashes like that ahead of time, because I was able to kind of discern what kind of personality someone has and whether or not it's going to be either a fit or a clash with, you know, other people at the office. Mm. So that for me, I think was probably the biggest thing that I learned for the first couple of months running the business, is just, you know, there are some people that they're just not going to fit as well as others with, you know, with the culture you're trying to build in a business.
And it's so valuable because you didn't only buy one business, right, and have one group of culture and backgrounds. You bought three and integrated them.
Yeah, and integrating, I would say, so, you know, I had the first business I bought, it was in Chicago. And so from an operational perspective, it didn't have as much overlap to the businesses in Las Vegas. But the third business I bought, integrating it with the second company in Las Vegas, it was a lot harder than I thought. And I think that's where a lot of people that they hear about business acquisitions, they think it's so easy. They're like, oh, well, the business is making this much. It's always going to make this much money. Integrating businesses is, you know, where the real money's made, right? That's where the rubber really hits the road. If you can't integrate people and systems and processes, that's where it's going to make or break. And we ran into quite a few issues with that because the old owner for the third business I bought, he ran things a specific way. They were very loose with the rules on compliance. And so there was a lot of things that we had to tighten up. And we ended up losing some of the office staff because they were just like, we don't want to have to follow all these rules. And they're like, why? You know, we've done it this way for 5-6 years. And said, you know, you might have been doing it this way for so long, but just because you did it this way doesn't mean it's the correct way to do it. And so that was a big frustration point for me because, you know, I saw a lot of the corners that were being cut, a lot of the rules that were being broken. And at the end of the day, they didn't see a problem with it. So kind of forcing them to say, hey, look, this is how we have to do things now, that resulted in some of them just saying, all right, fine, I quit. They didn't want to bother with it. So yeah, managing personalities is a big element in integrating businesses that I think most people overlook. It's not just a spreadsheet. Businesses are living, breathing organizations that have lots of different personalities you have to take into account.
100%. And I think you also need to take yourself into account in that situation. Like, how are you able to deal with people and how will people approach you? And like you said, you come from an Asian background, you know how to manage relationships. But that does not mean that everybody who stands on the other side of the table does the same thing and is able to do the same thing. Some people never experienced different cultures and they just cannot react or respond in the ways that we expect them to.
I'd agree.
From relationships in business, how is your personal relationships? Because I imagine that working so much, and also when you're 17 and you start that journey, you don't see the importance of relationships on your life. Maybe that's also a part of the balance that you mentioned. How did you approach relationships, and how do you define them for yourself now?
Yeah, I think relationships are always going to be tricky for someone who's got such a passion for something they're doing. At the end of the day, if you want to be successful in any given area of life, you're going to have to spend a lot of time in it. And so it becomes a question of, you know, what kind of relationships do you want to maintain on a personal level? And I don't know a lot of people that have successful businesses that can say, oh, I have a lot of friends. They have they usually have a smaller circle of friends that they have values that are aligned with, and they're similar, right? At the end of the day, and I was talking to somebody recently about this, but, you know, it's hard for me to make quote unquote regular friends because, like, what am I going to talk to them about? Like, if I go out to a bar and meet people, what kind of things are we going to have in common, right? If the biggest issue that they're worried about is, you know, getting drunk or, you know, fixing their truck or, you know, something small like that, and I'm worried about, okay, well, we have to close out this next fundraising round for, you know, $5 million, you know, or we're going to have to pay these penalties, you know, whatever the case might be, it's just a different level of problems that it's hard to have commonalities with people. And so, you know, most of the people that I talk with on a regular basis, they're guys that have their own businesses. They've had their own, either they own a business now or they, you know, bought and sold a business before. And, you know, they all have, you know, a certain level of personal ambition and personal discipline that have allowed them to get to those places in life. So, you know, for me, balancing personal life and personal relationships with, you know, work and everything, I think it's always going to be something that's going to be tough, but that's common to anyone who's a serious entrepreneur that really has goals and things they want to accomplish in their life.
You know, I am right now playing with the thought, what if there are relationships that actually help you propel you forward? Like, what if your personal relationships are as ambitious as you, maybe not in the same thing, but in a different thing? And with the people that I approach, it's like, how can I add value to their lives that they are as ambitious and as successful than I am? And I don't want to believe that it needs to be a balance. Like, I really don't want to believe that.
So you're saying, like, if they have ambitions in other areas besides business, like they're just, maybe they're ambitious with a personal hobby or like a sport maybe?
No, but for example, I have a really close friend here, and she was a D1 athlete in football, and now she transitions out of that, and she starts to like explore opening her own business and coaching. Right. And yes, she's in a different field, and she might not be interested in some of the things, but still, we can help each other. She has a different approach. She's still really ambitious in the things that she does.
Yeah.
And so having those types of friends makes me feel really, really balanced in a sense. But that's not everybody.
At the end of the day, those types of ambitions and personal discipline, it carries over, right? At the end of the day, to be a D1 athlete, you have to be willing to put in a lot of time. You don't understand personal time, you know, sacrifice, and, you know, putting in the effort. You got to show up every day to be a D1 athlete. You don't just kind of roll out of bed and become one, right?
But your colleagues, as the other athletes, are your best friends.
Yeah.
Like, those bonds are so strong. It's the same within the military. Like, the bonds between military guys, my sister's in the German military, they're so strong. Like, all of these people try to be at their best, like, high performing. And they're still so strong bonds. So I think that there's also a balance that is to be achieved when you have entrepreneurial success. I don't want to believe that is it's not working, at least for me. When you look back, what were the emotions that fueled you? Was it curiosity? Was it lack? Was it fulfillment? What fueled you?
I think for me, I was just not interested in working for anybody else because I had always had an entrepreneurial spark, you know, buying and selling airsoft equipment, to buying and selling watches, doing, you know, various different things. From a very young age, I always kind of knew I wanted to work for myself. And I just hated any kind of job where I was working for somebody else. Even if I was making a decent amount of money for my age with whatever it might be. So for me, it was just the desire to have independence over my time and to be able to do what I want. And so for me, the idea of having to work 40 hours a week for somebody else, even if I could turn it into a reasonable career where I, you know, made good money, it just wasn't something that interested me. So it was more really just the fuel to be independent.
Okay.
That drove me.
What was the first business you started? Like the first nitty-gritty thing?
Yeah, so I used to buy and sell airsoft stuff on Craigslist. Do they have Craigslist in Germany? No?
I don't think so.
Okay, it's a pretty big website. I imagine they do.
Maybe I don't know it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not the gamer buying airsoft,
Craigslist is more just for general buy and sell. So if you wanted to sell a couch or sell your car, whatever the case might be, it's a pretty big website for buying and selling stuff. Anyway, I would import lots of airsoft stuff from either China or from the mainland U.S. because I lived in Hawaii. So shipping was kind of expensive. So because I would ship it in bulk, I would get stuff at a big discount so I could turn around and sell it for a profit. So that was my first quote-unquote business. I was probably like 14, 15. My dad has a funny story about one time we had the local police department. They needed to buy a large amount of ammunition because they used airsoft guns for training, mm-hmm. for some of their training exercises. And I guess they needed ammunition, and I had lower prices than them going to a local store for it. So they would just come to me, and I would supply the local Honolulu Police Department for all their training exercises for ammunition, just the airsoft BBs, the 6mm plastic pellets. Yeah. So that was kind of my first thing. I switched to selling more equipment and refurbishing guns. That's what I would also do. I would buy guns in bulk from people online. They would ship them to me. I would fix them up, and then I would sell them. So that was another big thing I would do. I would buy guns for, $40 that were broken. I'd spend, maybe another $20 on parts to get it fixed, and I'd sell them for like $150 to $200 because I knew how to fix the guns. So that was kind of what I would do just for my personal, keep me busy.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
So you just needed something to do, and you were like, I want to make money in that time, so
yeah.
Why not do anything? Did you ever do a sports on the side, or was that your main focus?
I was involved in swimming, competitive swimming, and I don't know, chess. I don't know if you would consider chess a sport, but I played chess, and so did a lot of tournaments growing up in high school. But more of my quote-unquote actual sports was with swimming. So I did a lot of competitive swimming, so swim meets were a very regular thing for me growing up.
That is incredible. You used your time really well when you were younger then.
I think I was forced to. We were, a lot of people have this notion that homeschooling, you don't get out much, you have lots of free time. I didn't have a lot of free time growing up. I mean, I had speech and debate, I had civics group, I had swim team, I had PE, I had chess. I had, some kind of extracurricular event almost every day. Swimming was three times a week. So I was always very busy when it came to, my personal my personal and school related things growing up.
Mm.
So
I can relate to that. Are all of your siblings turned out similar the way that you did?
I wouldn't say that. No. I think my brothers have, though. They, my brother, my first brother, the one after me, he's running sales operations for a guy that does real estate right now. So he's, he's getting involved with a very entrepreneurial type position there, on top of, managing some of our own investments that we're pursuing in real estate. And then my brother after that, he's currently going through electrical contracting training. So he's learning how to be an electrical contractor, and he wants to eventually kind of run his own business. So I think for them, seeing that their older brother has carved a path for his life because he wanted to have it like, I always wanted to live life a certain way. I think they were able to see that, and they took after it in many respects because they saw, okay, well, I don't want to go to school and have a regular job. My first brother, he did finish college, and the other one, he's going through like a trade school program. So education to some degree is important for them, but they both kind of recognize after a certain point, education helps you to a degree, but after that, you've got to really just apply yourself in a vertical that you like and you can be passionate about.
That's amazing. But your sisters are not similar to that?
I have one sister who she's training right now to become a financial planner. So she's, she's studying accounting and all the finance things that you have to study to get all your financial planning licenses. you know, so she's got some plans for herself, her future, but she just recently got married, and I don't know if, like, I was telling her, you know, it would be very easy for her once she got her licenses to go out and buy her own financial planning practice, and I could help her do all that. And she's like, yeah, I don't know if I'd want to do that. I'd be, you know, happy just working for someone else, you know, with a stable job, because, you know, in financial planning, if you know what you're doing, you can make pretty good money with very flexible hours. So at the end of the day, if you don't, running your own business, it's not for everybody. Some people are perfectly content making, you know, a few a few hundred thousand dollars working 30 hours a week on a, you know, as a financial planner, for example. So that's kind of what she's looking at doing. But, and, you know, and all my other siblings are too young to really know what they want to do quite yet.
Understand. So when
what about you?
What about me?
Yeah. What about your siblings? You said you've got one in the military.
Yeah. So I also have three half siblings that are older than us.
Okay.
From my dad, so we're six in total, but not quite as extreme as you. We were also raised in somewhat of a really structured day. Like, compared to every one of our friends, we didn't have any time. Yeah. Like, we went to a usual school, and then we went until at 5 p.m. School ended at 5 p.m. We were the kids that needed to stay longest, because my father was working all the time and my mom didn't want us there because she was so busy. I mean, triplets. And after that, we came home. We had already done our homework, and then there was only one day of the week where we didn't do sports. So I did all of us did gymnastics until a certain point. I stopped that because I was worse than my sister and I hated it. Mm-hmm. And then I started pole dance, but I would still do pole dance at least five times a week. Mm-hmm. I tried to reach, like, I was always pushing the boundaries of them. Mm-hmm. I tried to go out by 13. I had my boyfriend by 15. Like, I pushed every single boundary that there was. I pushed it and I made it so that I made my will. And my siblings were just following in that. So I think that helped me a bit. That's why what makes us so different. So my sister's in the German military, and I love you a lot if you listen to that. But I think that she needed that structure.
Yeah.
Like, she didn't make it well without that structure that our parents raised us in. And my brother he's studying, and he might overtake the business, and he's growing into that role, but he's also searching his why a little bit more than I've been.
Got it.
A bit earlier.
Yeah, it's always interesting to see how siblings have different personalities. I guess in your guys' case, triplets, you know, you can end up so differently even though they're all born on the same day.
I think we influence each other. Like you said, right, like the existence of me influenced them so much. Like if your second brother would not exist, like would not be there, you would be different. Like, we cannot be the same personality just by the existence of someone else being there. We influence each other.
Right.
Mm, but yeah, many people are growing up, and with the ages of, like, in adolescence, they're still searching their purpose or their why or what they want to do. How was that for you? How did you find your purpose, in a sense? Did you find it, and how do you go about that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was very involved in civics and political related groups growing up. So, you know, we had a group that I was involved with. It was like mock government, and I also did speech and debate. So for me, I was always very interested in government policy and how government policy impacts people's lives, because, you know, obviously every law you pass, every new bill that you pass is going to have some impact on people's personal lives. Like, as an aside, my flight here initially got canceled because the government it's currently shut down at the time of this recording, longest government shutdown ever. And, you know, so that's a great example of how politics can directly impact people's lives. I had to rebook and, you know, had to go on a different airline because the first one I had was canceled. But when I was 17, I interned in Congress, and normally interning in Congress, because we lived in Northern Virginia, I was able to get to Washington, D.C. Most of the people that were interns, they were already in college, and I was only 17 at the time. And I thought I wanted to get involved in the world of politics, either working at some kind of political think tank or getting involved through some other way. But what really changed my opinion on that and why I decided to decided to focus on the world of business was because while I was working there, I was shocked at how few people called their congressional office, right? You would think, you know, my congressman, he's too busy to take phone calls or whatever. I worked at the office for about 6 months. We would rarely get more than 5 to 6 phone calls a day from, you know, their entire district, right? And so I realized politics, if you really want to have any kind of influence, you have to have influence in the world of business, because it takes money to get people elected. It takes money to, you know, to lobby for certain bills. Because while I was interning in Congress, I noticed that all these lobbying groups, they were always putting on free lunches. And I said, well, somebody has to be paying for all these free lunches. And so at the end of the day, somebody has to pay for the free sandwiches that are being handed out to influence politics. And I realized that if you want to have any kind of material impact on the world, you have to be someone who has resources. You know, to some degree, you can do it by just getting straight into politics, but it's a lot harder. You have to get elected. You have to, you know, have a couple lucky breaks as far as getting your voice out there, getting your name known. And for me, I didn't want to go pursue that path because I felt, A, it's a lot less consistent. You don't have as much control over that. And B, you're just not going to make a lot of money doing it, to be frank. So that's why I decided to get involved in the world of business from a pretty young age. I realized, you know, interning there at Congress at 16, 17 years old, if you want to have any kind of impact in the world, you have to have money. And so I studied, all right, well, what's the most formulaic, easy way to make money? And that's kind of why I discovered the world of acquisitions through Dan Pena and, you know, really just immersed myself in that space. So
it's so interesting. Throughout what we're talking right now, mm-hmm. the word impact seems to come a lot. It's like, yeah. How can I change the world? What is that underlying motive?
Yeah, I've always taken issue with a lot of the, like, the societal things that are happening in our country. I think our country's in a significant decline for lots of different reasons. You know, I think there's people that are in power that shouldn't be in power that get elected because, you know, people vote for them without really doing any research. So for me, I love the country that I live in, and I'm just tired of seeing the wrong people get into positions of power and pass terrible things that are having a detrimental impact on our country. So for me, it's just a matter of like, hey, I live here. I like this country. What the hell is everyone doing? Right. And so for me, that's what it's always been about. At the end of the day, I felt like if you can go out there and you're good at making money, you're good at building businesses, you want to allocate the resources that you can accumulate towards putting the right people in power. That way they can undo a lot of the crap that's been going on for the last couple of years in our country. You know, for example, I was an Eagle Scout, and at the time of me finishing my Eagle Scout, it was kind of around when the Boy Scouts started accepting a lot of things that are contrary to what they stood for, right? You know, you could, you know, I think the girls are allowed in now for the Boy Scouts. They've changed so much. And so for me, seeing things like that happen, it was like, it was just a mark on what's happening in our society as a whole. So our societal decline as a whole is a whole nother topic I could spend hours upon hours talking about. But for me, really seeing how things are declining is what motivated me to realize, okay, well, I have a certain set of skills. I'm good at these things. I want to use them and apply them as much as I can. That way I can impact things for a positive change. Because there's not a lot of people, I think a lot of people in positions of, you know, business success, they don't really give a shit about the country. You know, it's all about them. It's all about what can they accumulate for themselves. And, you know, to some degree they give back, they, you know, they put money towards certain causes and whatnot. But, I think it was Rockefeller who had a quote. You know, he said, "I believe that God has given me the skill to make money, and it would be a shame if I didn't use it to its fullest extent." And, you know, whether you want to vilify him or think he was, you know, a great person, you know, that's a whole separate argument. But at the end of the day, he was very successful with what he did. And because he had so much money, he was able to bend society to the will that he had of things that he thought should get, you know, passed. And that's what it comes down to for me as well, is I want to impact things in a way that will benefit society, because I like the country we live in, and I'm tired of seeing things going the opposite direction.
I think there's a value that got instilled into me through my father, or through his generation of entrepreneurs, in a sense. And that is that you take all the responsibility first. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is that you do, you take all the responsibility first, and it's a really value-driven entrepreneurial mindset.
Right.
So my father will speak similar to the person who wants to buy a small apartment and needs his help, and to the congressman or congresspeople in German national parliament. There's no difference in his tone of voice, in the length he would speak to those people, in the tips he would give them. Zero. because he has this fundamental like values. Like he gives all of the value that he can, and therefore money comes to him. Like it's not that he's like, yes, for sure, money is always in a topic when you're an entrepreneur, but it's a different type. Like you want to put something out there that is so great and it will bring value, and therefore you earn to be at that place. And I think that the younger some individuals get, the more they focus on it's only about the money. And as you said earlier, even in business, it's not only about the
money. It's a means to an end.
Exactly, exactly. But your end is impact.
Yeah.
And
well, because at the end of the day, how much money does one person ever need for themselves? Like, I don't really care about, you know, material things to a certain extent. Yeah, it's nice to have nice things, but you can't really spend, you know, all the money in the world on yourself. Like, what after a certain point, well, what is that going to do, right? You can buy nice clothes, you can buy nice things, you can go out and waste money on expensive vacations and whatnot, but wouldn't it be better to just take that and invest it in the future of, you know, your businesses, other people around you, society as a whole? That's always been my perspective on it.
So what is your rule on spending money maybe or investing it from a value perspective?
Well, I mean, I think the main value for investing is, you know, is it going to be something that multiplies upon itself, right? So I only invest in things that I understand and know. Like right now, I'm getting more involved in real estate because I understand real estate. It's pretty straightforward. I'm investing in, you know, the business venture I have in the crypto space because I understand what we're building. So, you know, I think the first rule of any kind of investing is before you consider like impact and, you know, all the other broader things is, you know, is this something that you understand and can have a direct impact with, right? I see a lot of people, they especially in the crypto space, it's very interesting, the mindset of people that invest in the crypto space versus traditional finance. A lot of guys in the crypto space, they throw money into something because they're just hoping it'll, you know, 50x or 100x, and that's really just more akin to gambling, you know, in my opinion. But you know, impact for me, I think a lot of people, they might care more about, and it was funny, I saw this when I was booking my flight back, but you know, there was an option to, you could pay an extra couple dollars to offset your carbon footprint. You know, you can pay extra money to do all these extra things that, you know, if you're really concerned about like CO2 impact, yes, you can do that. And, you know, I'm sure there's some kind of offset that would help there. But, you know, what kind of return is that really going to get you? You know, I don't know. So, you know, in a roundabout way, and to answer your question, I think, you know, investing for impact, at least, you want to make sure that what you're investing in or what you're putting your resources towards, it's something that's going to actually achieve whatever end you desire. So, you know, mainly for me right now, it's just making more money. I don't think I have the resources or, you know, the money to really make any kind of material impact yet in my career, in the social aspect that I want to, right? It's expensive to, you know, fund political campaigns and support groups like that. So for me, you know, I'll donate a little bit here or there, but really my focus is on, okay, well, you know, we need to accumulate resources up to X dollar amount, and then it's a snowball that'll keep spinning on its own. And then, you know, the profits of the snowball that'll spin off every year will be enough to go devote towards the things that I really want to. So I think at the end of the day, that's what everyone should strive towards, you know, build up a big enough capital base of resources that it'll sustain itself. And then whatever profits come from it, you can put towards other things you want to materially impact, because charity is expensive. I mean, if you spend, you know, if you're worth $10 million and you just put all $10 million towards charity, you're not going to be able to have a very long-term impact. You know, you're going to spend all your principal on whatever charitable cause you want, which, you know, that's fine. And I know a lot of people do that near the end of their lives. There's a lot of notable billionaires that have pledged the giving cause or whatever it's called, where they're pledging to give away the bulk of their net worth before they die. But I think if, you know, especially being younger, you have to considerably invest in growing the resources you have. That way you actually have, you know, a continuous amount to give towards the causes that you find important. Mm.
Is that also how you decide to spend your time?
I would say so, yeah. I think in many respects, I'm very kind of picky with my time, putting it towards resources, or not resources, but just putting it towards things that I'm directly involved with. I don't, you know, I get asked pretty regularly, people will reach out through LinkedIn, oh, can you help us with this? Can you help us with that? And you have to be pernicious with your time. You got to be careful with where you allocate it, because you only have 24 hours in the day. And if you get spread too thin, all of your all of your core efforts that you're working on are going to suffer. So I've got to be careful with what projects I get involved in, because I, you know, I feel like I've got enough on my plate as it is already.
Mm. So what standards maybe, or you seem not stressed, but I guess that there's a lot of pressure that you put yourself under. What standards on your time do you have, and on the people that you spend with, and on yourself?
I think when it comes to, it's probably best to break that down into two parts. You know, time, how do I spend my time? From the first thing that I do when I get up in the morning, you know, checking emails, getting back to people, my mind is always on work. And, you know, rightly or wrongly, I've been told it's, you know, probably not the healthiest thing to always be so focused on it. But at the end of the day, you know, if you're trying to build a business, if you're trying to build a venture, you have to be willing to spend, you know, 80 to 100 hours a week on it. It's got to be the first thing you think about when you wake up. If not, you know, can you run a successful side hustle, make a few thousand dollars here or there? Sure. But if you're trying to build something big, you have to be willing to put, you know, almost all your time into it. So, you know, that means I don't say yes to going out a lot. I don't go out to, it was funny, I was in Italy a couple of days ago, and it was like the first time I've been to a club in like probably 2 years, because it's just, that's not what I do. And I only went because it was a networking event for, you know, this blockchain convention we were at. So, you know, it's about being careful with what you say yes to with your time. You know, I would rather stay home and, you know, just work on my computer versus going out to some kind of random event that's not going to have any tangible benefit for the time I invest in it. And then, you know, to the second half of your question, you know, I've always struggled with that as a question, because what percentage of yourself are you fully using, right? If you're only putting 50% of your effort towards something when you know you could be doing more, closer towards 100, I don't think it's ever possible to fully give 100% into something, but you want to get as close as you can, right? You don't want to spend or only have a half effort into something, if that makes sense. So for me, it's always been a question of, okay, if I know that I am capable of, you know, X, how close can I get to that? Because, you know, from an efficacy standpoint, something's never going to be perfectly efficient, right? You're never going to be able to, like I said, give 100% into something. But from a standard on myself, every day when I'm falling asleep, I think, you know, what else could I have done today to get closer towards whatever goals or tasks that I had to finish up? You know, how did I waste time? What things did I do that were not productive with my time? So, you know, in many respects, I think I'm very harsh on myself. It's interesting because you ask about stress, you know, how are you stressed? And Elon Musk has a very good quote, you know, entrepreneurship, it's like just chewing on glass and staring into the abyss. It's a constant, you know, it's this constant effort towards something, and it feels like chewing on glass. So eventually you become accustomed to it. It's not pleasant, but, you know, if everything that you're doing from the first moment you wake up is you're thinking about whatever you're working on, you know, it can wear on you. So how stressed does that make you? Well, if you become accustomed to it, you don't become stressed. It becomes this effort of looking at how close was I today to achieving whatever my maximum output was. So I think it's an output question.
I'm so interested about what you would define as giving it your all. Like, what do you mean with you're 100% in it? Is it all of your time? Is it all of your effort? Is it all of your thought? Because you can give something all of your time and you can still think on the girl next door, right? Like there's certain things. Like what do you mean with those 100%?
Yeah, so for me, I'm giving 100%, it would just come down to, am I spending, you know, you just break it down hour by hour every day. Okay, if you're spending, you know, two-thirds of it on phone calls, okay, so, you know, you've got 40 minutes out of your 60 minutes on phone calls that you had related to a business, and you've got 20 minutes left over, you know, what are you doing with that other 20 minutes that's going to be productively applied? Are you wasting time just browsing social media? Are you wasting time on, you know, procrastinating, getting back on emails? I think it's going to look different for every person as to what they define as giving it their all. But for me, like, I know that when I'm locked in on whatever is in front of me, I can be incredibly efficient, incredibly productive, right? And it's, you know, it's interesting because I think you know, some people are better at it than others, like ADD, ADHD people. And I think I'm one of them. But when you have something in front of you that really fully engages you, you can become very focused and very locked in on it, and your output goes through the roof, right? So for me, it's always a question of how can I become that focus on whatever's in front of me without getting distracted with, you know, other smaller things out there. So how do you define giving it your all, giving it your 100%? I think only each person is going to know what that looks like based on how, you know, how good they can be with, you know, their work output. It's going to depend on each person.
I think everybody has that zone where they just have this one thing that they work on and they forget everything outside of that. It's also called the flow state.
Yeah.
By a really interesting professor. And it is something that needs to be somewhat new, but also not too new that you don't understand it.
Right.
And it's this phase where you forget yourself. Like, you just act.
Yeah.
When you say that what you do takes a lot of time and you are really strict on yourself, how do you balance that discipline with yourself and still compassion or self-love? Because I found, especially when you are hard on yourself, is you can destroy certain parts of yourself with that. Do you want to elaborate?
Yeah, I don't know if it's as much as destroying yourself, but you, I certainly understand what you mean. You know, by being too hard on yourself, you can desensitize yourself to the feelings of other people, you know, because you just, you're so focused on, you know, how critiquing yourself and critiquing at, you know, how much better you could be, you can become desensitized to how that impacts other people around you, right? Because it's not, it's just not something you're thinking about as much, right? How are my actions impacting, or how are making people around me feel? So I definitely get what you're saying. You know, coming from that perspective, it can be hard, especially on relationships with, you know, interpersonal friendships and relationships with people around you, because if you're so focused on critiquing yourself and, you know, being harsh on yourself, you just don't have the time to think about how what you're doing might impact other people around you.
Would you say you're an empathetic person?
It depends on what you mean by empathetic. You know, from a logical perspective, can I understand where people are coming from or what makes them think certain things or feel a certain way? I would say yes. You know, I'm very good at that in that regard. But, you know, truly empathizing with somebody versus understanding how they feel and why they feel what they feel, I think it's two different things. Like, it's, you know, understanding how they feel for whatever reasons there might be, it's different than actually truly fully empathizing with them. So, you know, how you distinguish those two things, I think it's very tricky.
Yeah, I learned this definition, and it was sympathy and empathy. So if you are sympathetic, you feel what, so for example, you see someone cry, and if you are sympathetic, you would start crying as well, because you sympathize with the same emotion, you get sad as well.
They're close, but they're different.
And then there's empathy, exactly, they're really close. And empathy would be like, I see someone crying, and you would not start crying, you would understand it's a sad moment, but you would be like, how can I help that person? Like, do I want to give him a tissue? Do I want to ask what is wrong? And so those are two, yeah, I think most people do not differentiate them well. Like, most people are really, really not good in differentiating that.
Yeah, they're two very close things, but yeah, they're quite different, especially when it's like practically applied.
So, coming to relationships or to the success, how did your definition of success, quote unquote, and I love that definition, it's always a good thing to hear how people define success, but how did that evolve from the 70-year-old who just changed his mind, we need to go into business because there's the biggest impact, versus the 27-year-old by now, correct?
Correct.
How did that change?
I think for me, I've come to realize, especially like in the last probably 2-3 years, that having the right business relationships are just as important as the money you can make off of business, right? For me, having a key relationship or a key introduction to someone might be worth, way more than, you know, a couple $1,000s, right? Just having the right point of contact, because money is just a representation of how much time other people takes to do something, right? If you think about money and time are very closely interlinked. And so, and I think especially with conversations around wealth inequality today, it's a big thing that people misunderstand, right? Like Jeff Bezos, he's not rich and worth as much as he is because he somehow stole this money from poor people. It's, you know, he provided a really great service through Amazon, right? So at the end of the day, whenever you're paying somebody for something, it's because it's better for you to pay them for whatever product or service they're offering than it is for you to do it themselves. Like, I remember reading something about somebody wanted to see what it would cost to make his own hamburger if he did everything himself. You know, so from going around sourcing the meat, doing this, that, it ended up being like $100. And it's like, that doesn't make any sense from a practical standpoint. And so I think the relationship between time and money is something that's very important to understand, you know, in that regard. People make money as a direct representation of how much time they're saving other people. And so when it comes to personal relationships and business, having the right people around you who can fill the gaps that you're not good at, those relationships are very hard sometimes to put a true value to, because they could be saving you, you know, infinite amounts of time, right? Especially on the areas that you're not good at, right? Think about just the recording studio we're in right now. I mean, if you wanted to go set this up at your own place, it would take a lot of time, effort, and money to get the equivalent set up. But, you know, because it's a recording studio that's specifically catered towards recording these types of things, it's very convenient for us, right? So.
And also Jeff Bezos as an example, right? Like, the world is so much better. You can have everything that you want in 1 or 2 days, like that you can imagine.
Yeah.
And so I think I have a really strange opinion about billionaires. I think they're one of the best things in the world. And if they're responsible with it, like that drives our world.
Well, at the end of the day, you don't become worth $1 billion without having some kind of impact in the world that saves other people more than $1 billion, right? Because, fair. You know, think about it. Let's say I came up with an invention that costs half of whatever the current market was. Like, I came up with a new way to manufacture these microphones, right? And we were able to produce them at half the cost of what they are now. People buy them, you know, we're saving everybody money. So you don't become worth $1 billion without having some kind of material economic impact that's multiple times over, right? If you look at the market cap of Tesla, Amazon, or any of these big companies, and you look at, you know, what the founder's share of it is, like Mark Zuckerberg, how much equity has he created for other people through Facebook, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, you know? So everyone wants to say, oh, well, you know, he's worth this, he's worth that, he's got too much money, too much power, too much influence. At the end of the day, all the people that invested in Facebook, they have had, you know, significant returns because of it. And I think that's a big misunderstanding people have, especially with like these big asset managers too, because most of the money that is under management at these asset managers like BlackRock and similar, it's pension money. You know, at the end of the day, it's money that is being held kind of in trust for other people that are retiring or retirees. So, you know, every time, like you said, I think people that have created significant amounts of personal wealth, I think they're offering a service to society that is very much misunderstood, because everyone looks at it and it's like, oh, well, he has this much money, he's bad. And the other big thing that I think is misunderstood is that a lot of times that net worth is tied up in the equity value of the company. It's not like they can liquidate it overnight. Like Elon Musk, he just got his $1 trillion pay package. Okay, well, that's almost all going to be stock in Tesla. Like, they're going to grant him more stock and equity in Tesla if he hits all the milestones. He can't liquidate $1 trillion worth of Tesla stock in overnight. Otherwise, the stock price would crash and it would be worth nothing, right? So it's kind of this fundamental misunderstanding that people have around wealth, is that it's tied up in the value of a business, right? Very few times it's going to be very liquid.
I mean, you can still borrow against a share, right?
You can still borrow against it.
Get cash even if you don't liquidate it. It's a bit of a different set, but yes. Most of the people that we define as billionaires today, or like what their assets, it's not as liquid as we believe it to be.
Well, that, and if you look at a lot of people that have generated significant net worth in like privately held technology companies, like if they're not able to deliver on their goals, that evaporates overnight. If you look at like Elizabeth Holmes, she was considered a billionaire, right? But then, you know, Theranos ended up being a complete fraud and that collapsed. Where did all that equity value go? It just disappeared, right? Same thing with Sam Bankman-Fried. Now, don't get me started. I think that he got railroaded and shafted because FTX wasn't truly bankrupt, and that's a whole nother argument that he's trying to make. But, you know, he had significant net worth that was tied up in the value of FTX, and then, you know, they got forced into liquidation. You know, his net worth evaporated almost overnight. So net worth and all that, it can be very tricky to calculate, especially for privately held companies that are reliant on venture capital valuations, especially with anything tied to AI or, you know, software technology where the multiples are very high. But at the end of the day, they're fetching those valuations because people that are investing money believe that the impact of that company is going to be worth that much in the long term, especially with how much money you see getting pumped into AI startups these days, which is crazy amounts of money.
Is it one goal of yours to have that much impact as those people?
Impact, yeah. That's tricky to say because I think a lot of people that are developing these AI technology companies, I don't think they truly understand the long-term impact that it's going to have societally. Like, you have so many jobs that I think are going to get automated out of existence by AI technologies, especially like low-paying call center jobs, you know, customer support roles. You have AI agents that are so good now that they can effectively replace, you know, a lot of these $6 or $7 an hour overseas workers. You know, what is going to happen to those people long term? What other jobs are going to become available for them? And it's not to say AI is bad, but I think it's AI is going to require people to just become higher skilled in order to really have some kind of good, you know, income. You know, for example, my dad is using, he does a lot of big data analytics stuff, and he's been talking, you know, he's told me about the impact that AI is having for his work. It's just making them all more productive. So instead of, they can get the work done, you know, of five people, you know, five people can do the work of what it would probably take 25 people 5 years ago, right? Because AI is able to do so much of the heavy lifting. So
I think there's this interesting argument about people in AI that they say, okay, we make people so much more effective. You only need five people for the work of blah, blah, blah. So then that will drive more freedom to these people and more freedom to everybody else. And then nobody will need to pay. I don't know. Like, I've spoken to AI entrepreneurs, and they really deeply believe that their change in the world will drive to everybody else not needing to work anymore because the AI works. And right. I just ask one question. It's like, and you think that someone who is able to generate a bigger margin because of AI will give that margin to consumers? I'm just asking. Like, I'm just questioning. And everybody goes, no. And I'm like, okay, can we close the circle then?
Where does it go? Where do the savings go?
That's a really good question.
Yeah. Well, and I think at the end of the day, you can't tax it away from people. Like, oh my God. You know, because a lot of, and that's a whole nother issue. Like, a lot of these people, they're generating significant wealth just out of the appreciation of the value of the businesses that they're involved with. But that's not all directly translating to money that's getting, you know, flowing into the economy.
No, right? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And there's so many, let's say, roadblocks in that system that most people believe that, oh yeah, it works that way, and it actually doesn't. But ending with the business part, maybe a bit, and I know that's really hard. I would love to understand, when your younger self would see you today, what would surprise him about you the most?
I think the areas that I've decided to get into would be of the most interest and surprise. But I think it's also because back then, you know, cryptocurrency, when I first bought my business, like, I knew about Bitcoin. Bitcoin was a few hundred dollars. If I could have gone back, of course, I would have bought as much as I could at, you know, $800, whatever it was in 2017, 2016. But I think what's the most different about me today in the businesses that I'm choosing to involve myself in are ones that I think have a bigger scale and a bigger impact, right? Because the businesses I bought before, in the healthcare space, we could only impact a few hundred people every year, right? Because we're providing a service, you know, we're sending nurses out, we're sending physical therapists out. We could only impact a couple hundred lives a year. The businesses that I'm involved in now are ones that can impact people around the world. Like, we're building a platform that would allow anybody to set up a crowdfunding campaign to support whatever cause they want around the world, right? So if somebody needed to raise money for a humanitarian effort, if somebody needed to raise money for you know, medical bills, it could be any type of thing, but anybody could use our platform. And so for me, realizing that the way to really make money is to just scale your addressable market, right? The addressable market for, you know, a home health business, it's going to be whatever their local market is, right? The license is only good for the state or the counties that they operate in. And so I think realizing that, you know, just getting into businesses that have a bigger addressable market, a bigger scale to people you can help or, you know, bring on as customers, that would be the biggest surprise for me. Because I don't know if I ever really thought about, you know, when I first bought my business at 19, okay, where am I going to be in, you know, 5 to 8 years? What kind of businesses am I going to be involved in or running? But I think just getting into bigger addressable markets was something that I didn't think about as much, you know, when I was first getting into it. But yeah, at the same time, when I was first getting into, you know, the acquisitions world, I was just looking at, you know, what has a consistent addressable market need. I was kind of reverse engineering it. And that's how I picked the industry that I ended up getting into, was I just looked at, you know, what has a consistent need, what's never going to go away. You know, Medicare, home health services are something that billions of dollars a year are always going to get spent on it. So.
And grow really long, because we live longer, but we don't live healthy longer.
Right.
Maybe one last question. How do you define yourself if it is not about business or your age or any other definition? How would you define yourself?
Oh, God, that's a tough one. I think for me, a lot of my self-identity is in my work, because at the end of the day, that's what I enjoy. That's what I'm passionate about. I think it would be hard to split me up from that, because at the end of the day, you know, I've got a couple hobbies. I play chess. You know, I go swimming when I can. But really what it comes down to for anybody is, you know, what defines them as a person, you know, what, how can you truly separate somebody from their passions and, you know, what they do for work? And I think a lot of people, like if you took somebody like my brother, who he's going to electrical contracting school, you know, he doesn't necessarily want to do it all his whole life, but for him, that's what he enjoys. That's what he's learning, and that's what he's getting good at. So for him, how would I ever split that up from his identity after he's got, you know, 5 to 10 years of experience in it? I think it'd be tricky, but, you know, how would I define myself if it weren't just about the work and just about the, you know, the things I've done in the business world? I think for me, it would just be about, you know, my personality is a very intense personality. I like committing a lot of my energy and willpower into something to get good at it. Right. Like everything that I've ever done as a hobby was something that I got heavily involved in. Right. Whether it be I played piano for multiple years. I was given the option, you know, when I first started piano lessons, my mom basically said, you only have to do it for 1 year. If you don't want to do it after that, you can stop. But after a year, I realized, well, this is frustrating because I'm not that good at it still. So I want to get good at it. And so I continued taking lessons for a long time. Same thing with, you know, chess or any other thing that I got involved with. For me, it was about, if I'm going to get involved with something, I want to get good at it. And so I don't know if that's a perfectionist habit coming out, but hopefully that answers the question.
I think it's a competitive. It's a beautiful answer.
It's a competitive mindset.
And I have the same. And yeah, it doesn't always serve me.
Yeah.
But yeah. Thank you so much for your time,
yeah,
Josh. It was an absolute pleasure.
Yes.